Welcome to Technovation, a weekly conversation with people who are shaping the technology landscape. I'm Peter High, president of Meta Strategy, advisor to technology executives, Forbes columnist, book author, and your host. Each episode of Technovation features insights from top executives and thought leaders at the intersection of business, technology, and innovation. If you like what you hear, we'd be grateful if you give us a rating on iTunes or through whatever other source you use for podcasts. And please subscribe so you don't miss a thing. Thank you. My guest this week is Scott Adams. Scott is the creator of Dilbert, the satirical office humor comic strip that spawned books, video games, and merchandise. He's also the author of multiple books, including the number one bestseller, The Dilbert Principle, and his latest book, Loser Think, How Untrained Brains Are Ruining America. Scott has been awarded the National Cartoonist Society's Reuben Award for Outstanding Cartoonist of the Year, the highest award in the profession. Prior to creating Dilbert, Scott had a career in the corporate world, which included stints with Crocker National Bank and Pacific Bell. In this interview, Scott shares his story of leaving the corporate setting to become a cartoonist, a dream of his since the age of 11. When he discovered the corporate world wasn't for him, Scott took a chance and reached out to a legendary cartoonist named Jack Casty for advice. And based on that conversation, he sent his work to big magazines and was summarily rejected. However, a year later, Cassidy reached out to Scott again to check in. This prompted Scott to try again and send his work to major cartoon syndication companies, and he eventually got a contract at United Media, and Dilbert got published. We also discuss how Scott has made his life more efficient so he can fit more into his days, the formula Scott uses when turning a tweet into a joke, how people don't think about the world productively enough, why we need to think more like economists, scientists, and engineers, and a variety of other topics.
Well, Scott Adams, welcome to Technovation. It's great to speak with you today.
Thanks for having me.
No, it's a pleasure. Scott, I thought we'd begin with your pathway to becoming a cartoonist. I was really intrigued to learn that this was a dream of yours as early as the age of six. You thought you might become a famous cartoonist, in fact. And I wondered, as somebody who grew up in upstate New York, you know, where this idea came to mind. How did this come about?
Well, it's not unusual for young kids to want to be cartoonists and, you know, basketball players and whatever they know that's a job that's a famous person. So it probably wasn't that unique to want to be a cartoonist. I know lots of kids who want that. What was different is it worked out for me. But I have to say that around the age of 11, I started to thinking it was an impractical goal, because how many people become Charles Schulz? It just seemed really out of reach. So from the age of 11 through college, and for a few years into my corporate world, my cubicle life, I thought it was impractical to do something that unlikely. But things weren't working out in my corporate career, and I thought, well, maybe I'll just try some things that are riskier in terms of the odds of them paying off, but they're not going to kill me if they don't. And so one of the things I tried was cartooning. It was on a list of other things I tried. I tried to invent things. I tried to make software. I tried a bunch of things. But that's the one that worked. So part of my process was just chipping away and trying one thing after another until I could get some traction.
And how much experience had you had at that point of actually cartooning? Did you do it for your college newspaper, or is it something you did, you know, growing up even just for yourself?
I was a doodler all my life. My mother was an artist. She was, you know, mostly she was raising the kids, but in her spare time, she would do landscape art. So I think there's probably some kind of genetic component that, you know, I just picked up some ability or maybe interest in art that way. But I didn't have any formal training. I did take one drawing class in college and ended up with the lowest grade in the class. I was informed that comics are not art. So that didn't work out with me. So you could say I had a little, but it wasn't really relevant to anything I ended up doing.
Yeah, that's interesting. I also, before we leave your childhood, I was also intrigued to find that you believe from a very early age that you grew up to be wealthy and famous. Again, something that maybe isn't so unusual for kids, but again, something you've ended up accomplishing. But what was the source of your confidence growing up?
Well, it's, I realize how this sounds, but I'm going to say it anyway, because I'm way past the point where things embarrass me anymore. But when I was a kid, it was a very small town. There were only, I think, 40 people in my graduating class. And most of those people I went to kindergarten with. So just imagine the smallest environment you could ever imagine. And then imagine that as a little kid, people would continuously tell me, adults, that I was going to be rich and famous someday. So people would tell me that all the time. My mother told me, strangers told me. I had somebody stop me on a sidewalk once and tell me that literally. And I don't know why, but I think that something about other people's opinion, plus I think some people are just born with confidence that's not really related to the facts. And I've always had confidence that seemed unrelated to, you know, what the actual situation was.
You mentioned that before going into cartooning, you at the age of 11, that dream died, at least for a little while. I guess died is the wrong word there, but that was put on hold at a minimum. And you went into business. You worked in technology at Crocker National Bank and at Pacific Bell. And you've described yourself actually as a great worker. You've said you'd hire yourself if you could. And so I'm wondering. Oh, I'm sorry. Please, was there? Did you want to share there?
Oh yeah, I was just gonna emphasize that. I show up on time. I have my marks. I work more than I'm supposed to. Yeah. So go ahead.
No, exactly. And so I'm wondering. You know, a part of what makes Dilbert so great is shining a light on the absurdity of the office place. And I'm curious, as somebody who was such a great worker, somebody who was so motivated, somebody who did want to advance, was there a tinge of I don't know, cynicism, or at least taking note of the absurd of the office environment, even as you were taking it so seriously during that period?
Well, no matter how competent the employees are, they're still in the system, and the system can be pretty rotten, especially if it's a big organization and has a ton of bureaucracy. And that was my experience at a big bank and then the phone company. And so it didn't matter what qualities you brought to the situation. The situation was just quicksand. And I think probably over my entire career, if you could go back in time and erase me, you know, if you had a way to just make me not exist anymore, that both of those companies would be in exactly the same place that they were. Literally nothing would be different. You could just erase me from history and nothing I did would have contributed to the bottom line.
Well, and perhaps in some ways, the realization of that had you doing some things on the side. You mentioned you attempted a few different potentially entrepreneurial ideas. You talked about developing some software, et cetera, on your own. But it also pushed you back in the direction of your old dream of cartooning. And I've heard the story that you happened to be flipping through the channels. You caught a PBS show with Jack Cassidy, a cartoonist. And though you didn't catch the full show, you elected to write him in order to get advice on cartooning. And I wonder if you could pick up the story from there and tell that one. I think it's a really interesting one.
Yeah, people have to understand that this was pre-internet. So imagine the days when you wanted to learn how to do something and you literally didn't have any way to do it. You know, maybe there was a book in the library if you could figure out what it was and how to find it. But I lucked out, and I'm not sure that luck is the right word, because my experience is that when you focus on an objective, you start noticing things in your environment. And there's some science behind this that, you know, it's the same reason that you can hear your name in a crowded room. There's a lot of room noise and you hear blah, 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 Scott, blah, 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 blah. So once you focus on something, you tend to start noticing things in your environment that you wouldn't have noticed otherwise. And maybe that was the case. So I noticed this show. I wrote to the host, said, how do you become a cartoonist? And he wrote back with a 2-page handwritten letter in which he told me what books to buy and what materials to use and how to submit them. And so I followed his instructions, got the books, got the materials, drew some comics that I thought were terrific. Sent them off to the major magazines that bought comics in those days. New Yorker and Playboy were the big customers. They paid the most, and they were rejected. So I got my rejection letters, and I thought, well, you know, I tried. I did what I could do. It's not going to work out. So I put my materials in the closet, and I just forgot about it for a year. And at the end of the year-ish, I go to my mailbox and there's a second letter from Jack Cassidy, the guy who gave me the first advice. And it was weird that he had sent a second letter because I hadn't even thanked him for the first bit of advice. And I opened up his letter and he said he was cleaning his office and he came upon my samples I'd sent a year ago. And he said he was just writing to make sure that I hadn't given up. And I had given up. And I thought, well, why would anybody write a letter? There was no other, no ask, no request, no follow-up. There was no other intention of the letter but to make sure I hadn't given up a year after the advice. Just think about that. And so I thought, well, maybe he saw something there that others didn't see that even I can't see. So I got my materials out and I created Dilbert and sent it to the major cartoon syndication companies. And the way syndication works is that a cartoonist has a big break if they get a deal with a syndication company, because then it's that company that sells it to all the newspapers around the world and helps you with your licensing and stuff. So I sent it off to the major syndication companies. There were, I think, five-ish. And pretty soon the rejections came in. And I thought I had them all. I'm not very organized, but I thought they had all rejected me. And I thought, well, now I've tried twice. It didn't work out. It's obvious that this isn't my future. So I put all my materials in the closet again, literally in the closet, and I just forgot about it again. And a few months later, I get a phone call from a woman who said that she worked for a cartoon syndicate I'd never heard of. It was something called United Media. And I said, and she said she was offering me a contract to be a syndicated cartoonist. And I thought, this is weird, just a phone call. And the biggest break a cartoonist could ever have is just going to come out of the blue from some company I'd never heard of. And I said, well, you know, I'm flattered by your offer. By this time, I was an experienced negotiator at my day job. And I said, but, you know, I haven't heard of your outfit, this United Media company. Could you maybe give me some references? Is there anybody you've worked with that I could talk to, maybe who's a cartoonist who's ever been published through your outfit? And there was this long pause, and then she says, yeah, we handle Peanuts and Garfield at the time, and about 12 other names she listed. And that's when I realized that something was happening, and I stopped negotiating at that point and said, hell yeah. So the part that confused me is she had used her corporate name instead of the syndication name, which I wasn't familiar with the company that owned the syndication. So that's why I didn't realize I was talking to literally the one person on the planet who was most important to my career ambitions, because it turned out to be the biggest syndication company and the person who makes the decision. So that just came out of the blue for me. So then Dilbert got published, but it languished and was near failure for the first several years. And then some events turned my way.
And actually, one of the events which has a nice tie to your latest book, Loser Think, How Untrained Brains Are Ruining America, is the idea of do bad work in public. You note this as an important thing and actually have talked about and written about the connection back to your early times as a cartoonist, that Dilbert originally, the cartoons had him in all sorts of scenarios, not just in the office, but at home and out and about and so on. And it was feedback from people who were reading that offered the advice to put him in the office. And actually, I've also read that the key to getting that advice was including your email. And this is in 1994, not necessarily at a time when email was completely pervasive. Can you talk a bit about that story and the connection point of and the insight that led you down the path towards making Dilbert more of a success?
Yeah, the universe tends to reward energy. So it's just better to do something than to do nothing. And one of the pieces of advice, as you mentioned in my new book, Loser Think, is that if you can't figure out how to do something right, and let's say it's a career ambition or some other kind of ambition, the best way to get free advice is to do it wrong and just do it in public, because people love giving you advice if they see you've done something wrong. Now, with Dilbert, I didn't have experience as a cartoonist. I was just sort of guessing a lot of stuff. And I put it out there. And the key was really including my email address between the panels of the strip. And then just hundreds, not hundreds, thousands, thousands and thousands of people emailed me. I was at one point, I was getting 1,000 emails a day. And they gave me largely the same advice. They said, we like the comic a little bit, but we love it when he's in the office. And it was so consistent, and so many people said that, that I thought, well, it's a good thing I don't have any artistic integrity, because I'll just make that change. So, you know, if you think like an artist, you tend to put your ego first. But my training was not in art. It was in economics, and I had an MBA from Berkeley. And so to me, the customer rules. You know, if you take business training, you learn to do what the customer wants, and that's what they ask for. So I made that adjustment, and that was, of course, the biggest key to success.
And it's interesting. I believe I've read, you'll correct me if I have this incorrectly, but that some of the inspiration for the comics now come from the comments, on things people mention that are happening in offices. And it occurred to me, actually, as I was reading a story about this, that you've not really been in an office for 25 some years. And so I suppose there are some aspects of this that are universal, and perhaps that's been validated for you, that you're getting comments from your readers that harken back to the time when you were in the office. But I'd be interested in that feedback loop that you have and how it inspires your work.
Yeah, I noticed there was some universality to the, let's say, the Dilbert experience and work when I first moved from my first big job at a bank. And I thought, well, there's no other company that could have this kind of problems. Yeah, I'm going to go to another company. And I went to the phone company. It was Pacific Bell at the time. And I thought, thank goodness, I've gotten away from all that bureaucracy and craziness and backstabbing and all the things that you're familiar with. And then it was exactly the same. And it was the same in a way that was just shocking. I thought to myself, I'm sure that what was wrong with the last company is that the people were defective. How can I move to a second company with all these same kinds of defective people? And I started to piece it together that there were some universal truths about putting people together with a hierarchy and, you know, set of objectives. You end up with the same craziness no matter who the people are. And so that was key to understanding that if I wrote about this experience, which almost nobody was at that time, that people would relate to it no matter what company they were in. Indeed, there were a lot of people who wrote to me in the early days and said, I know you must work at my company because there's no way you could be writing this stuff without directly observing, you know, my company. And they meant it. They meant that literally. And there were hundreds and hundreds of people would email me and say, okay, I know you're in my company. You work at, I don't know, Hewlett Packard or IBM. Those were some of the ones that came up all the time. PG&E, that came up a lot. So there was something universal. And now when I need material, sometimes I'll just tweet, tell me what's bothering you in your job. I'll get hundreds of responses. And out of the hundreds, 99% are comics I've already done. But there's always a nugget in there somewhere.
And can you talk a bit about your process from that point? So when you find the nuggets, I'd love to understand a little bit more about how you work. Like what's the process then, the extent to which, I mean, I assume that it's, I know that as somebody who prides himself as being very efficient, you know, what's the process then to tease that out into a comic?
So when I say I find a nugget, I just mean a situation, not the humorous part of it. Just there's something bothering somebody, and it's a type of thing that other people would recognize. So I have what I call a humor formula, and I don't rigorously apply it, but just generally speaking, there are about six dimensions that you want to work into a joke. You want to get as many as possible in there. If you can get two of the six dimensions, people will recognize it as a joke. If you get three, it's the funniest thing they've seen all week. And if you get four, you're rich, because it's very hard to do that. So without getting into the details of the formula, let's just say that some of the elements are, let's say, naughtiness, bizarreness, cleverness, that sort of thing. So if you can recognize those things in your joke, and you've got two out of three, you got a joke. So I fairly rapidly cycle through them, not thinking of it in the detail that I've explained it, but rather, you know, it's sort of like touch typing. You know, you don't have to look at the keyboard if you do it enough. So I can look at a situation now and say, all right, with my characters, how would they misuse this? If they were selfish, what would they do? If they were dumb, what would they do? And since most of my characters are established and they have identifiable traits, you know, there's somebody who's angry, somebody who's lazy, et cetera, I can usually figure out which of those personalities to put in the situation to ruin it, you know, to make the worst thing happen, because that's usually what people laugh at is watching ordinary things turn into the worst case scenario.
It's interesting. And you've talked about, I'd love to talk a bit about the transition from cartoons to writing books. You've talked about how being humorous in a cartoon is difficult. You talked about, you know, you just momentarily, a moment ago, you mentioned, you know, having sort of 3 points of humor versus four and the key to that, but the difficulty in so doing. But you've also talked about that being humorous in a book is much more difficult. And why make that difference? Like what inspired you to do so when you had a formula already that was so successful? Were you looking for that next challenge and recognize this as the next hill to take?
I wish I could say that it was such a planned march, but what happened was it was the mid-90s, and I got a request from the Wall Street Journal to write a guest editorial because they followed the comic and they thought, well, comics about work and business, so we'll ask them to do a guest editorial. And so I did, and it was called The Dilbert Principle. And I talked about the concept of the lesser qualified technical employees being promoted to management because you wanted your good technical people to just do technical jobs. And that caused the least capable people to become the managers of the capable. So that got a lot of attention, and that attracted a publisher. And so Adrian Zakheim, who now is my same publisher who's moved to Penguin, and he's also the same publisher behind my new book, Loser Think. But years ago, he saw that article and he thought, I like the writing. I'm kind of putting words in his mouth here, but maybe there's a book in there. So he contacted me and said, hey, how about writing a book? And I said some form of, I've never written a book. I don't know how to write a book. Sounds like a lot of work. Yes. So what? One of my processes is that I say yes to opportunities, even if I don't know how to do them. Because again, good way to learn how to do something is to do it wrong. So I wasn't worried too much about doing it wrong, because I figured, well, that's a good way to find out how to do it right. So I plunged in and wrote my first book. It was called The Dilbert Principle. And it was the easiest book I've written because I really was just taking my work experiences and just downloading them into a book. And that became an enormous number one bestseller for a long time. It just sold a lot of books. And that, when it hit number one on the charts, it changed my world. And Dilbert and I have never been the same.
And it was Dennis Rodman who you overtook, if I recall the story correctly.
Yeah. Yeah, I was sitting in second place for weeks as Dennis Rodman's, was it a biography, I guess, or autobiography, his book. I don't think he wrote it, but it was about him.
Technically a biography,
there was nothing more annoying than watching that sit there in the number one spot. But when it broke and I edged it out, that was one of the best days of my life, I got to say.
That's great. You've mentioned that, you know, if you have a superpower, if you have a you know, something that makes you particularly successful, one of those things is the idea of simplification. And I believe you've noted that this comes from having spent time as a youngster on a farm of your uncle's, a family farm, and that farmers have to be very efficient, have to find sources of efficiency in order to be successful. And the lessons of that time have made their way into your business career, as well as now into your cartooning, your book writing, We could talk soon about some of the other activities like podcasts and so forth that you're involved with as well. And I thought this would be a good point to introduce this concept of efficiency, because, you know, as you've taken on additional challenges, you've not dropped the other ones. You remain a cartoonist as you also write books. You do both of those as you now do a podcast. And I wonder, what's your process of finding the time in order to fit more things into an already very busy day?
An excellent question, and the answer is more interesting than maybe you had hoped. I have a process in which I continually chip away at everything that's inefficient a little bit at a time until it almost becomes easy. For example, with cartooning, it used to be pens on paper and photocopies and mail it through the mail. Now, some of that changed without my help. You know, now, obviously, we submit stuff digitally, so that saved a lot of time. But I was one of the first, maybe the first, I think I was the first syndicated cartoonist to start drawing it entirely in a digital form on the computer. So that saves an entire step. You don't have to scan it. It's easier to clean up things faster. Before that, I did just the lettering. I figured out how to do the lettering on a computer after I'd drawn the art. So little by little, first the lettering, then the entire art. And then more recently, I rough out the comic and send it to an assistant, just the dailies. I still do the Sunday comic the old way, just so I'm still creating it. But the dailies, I have an assistant who works from my rough art. And, you know, since the characters always look the same, there are just so many millions of times I can draw a Dilbert. So now I have an assistant who finishes the art. So between all those things, the cartooning got easier. Plus the fact that as you become experienced, it's just easier. Everything's faster and easier with experience. Then on the periscoping, the live stream that I do every morning, I literally do that in my pajamas before I've shaved, before I've done anything except had my coffee. And I literally just talk about stuff that interests me and I would have wanted to talk to a friend about anyway. So it comes so easily that I don't even think of it as work. The live streaming I think of as something I would do for fun. So those are a couple examples. But in general, I'm just continuously, aggressively looking for ways to make things more efficient. That's the farmer in me as well.
And you've mentioned that you, for most of your adult life, have worked 7 days a week. I suppose it's because of that efficiency that you can fit more things in. But I wonder, do you foresee a time where you would wish to start taking a day off or a weekend off, like most people? Or perhaps it's the answer you just gave, that you found the things that don't feel like work, and therefore doing those things on a daily basis, it doesn't feel like you need any further time off because it's a bit more like a relaxation time than it is about, the traditional work. But I'm curious.
Yeah, there are hard weeks in what I do. Like this week will be a hard week because I'm traveling and, you know, my hours are crazy. Going to get up at 3 a.m. tomorrow, I think. So this week, I wish I didn't have to experience. But generally speaking, I wake up in the same place I work. I grab my coffee, still my pajamas. I sit down. I make some jokes that aren't too hard. I do some periscoping that I enjoy more than the audience probably enjoys it. And then writing books, though, is super hard, as you mentioned earlier. The level of difficulty to write a book, imagine if you will, since when I write books, they have to be at least a little bit humorous or people will be disappointed. So I've got to work a layer of humor into a book. And if I don't have something in there every page or two, people are going to notice it's missing. So that, you know, 300 page book times, you know, two. So you've got hundreds of humor points across the book. And that's only if you're a humor writer. But I also have to have content, you know, it has to make sense. There's research, there's all kinds of stuff. So it's the books are work. Those are the only parts that I feel as work.
Well, let's talk a bit about your most recent book, which is Loser Think. And it is a book in which you argue it's important that we all have an ability to think like a psychologist, like a scientist, like an economist, like an artist, an entrepreneur, a leader, an engineer. It's important to remove some of these blind spots in our thinking, not to the point of becoming trained, formally trained in each of these disciplines, but to know enough about them to incorporate some of the aspects of those disciplines into our daily thinking. I'd love to hear a bit about the inspiration behind this book. What was the insight that drew you towards this topic?
So I spent a lot of time on Twitter debating the topics of the day, and partly because I enjoy it. And I noticed that when people would respond to me with well-thought-out comments, even if I disagreed with them, I would check their profile, and you'd often find they're economists or they're lawyers. And then when people would say things that were just crazy, that as if they had never learned how to think, I would click on the profile, and more often than not, it would be usually some kind of artist or musician. I guess they're all artists. And I thought to myself, is there something about the self-selection or something about their lack of exposure to how to think productively that's causing that? But the perfect example is an economist knows how to compare things, as would a scientist, and I imagine a lawyer would pick that up as well. Whereas an artist doesn't really learn that skill, but doesn't know that they don't have it, which is really the trick. Because people think they have common sense until somebody points out that there's something wrong with the way they're thinking. Let me give you a concrete example. If you said to an artist, is the president doing a good job? And it doesn't matter which president you're talking about. They're going to say yes or no. And they'll be pretty confident about that. But if you take that to, let's say, a scientist or an economist, and you say, how is this president doing? If they're on their game, they're going to say something like this. Compared to what? Because we don't have another president doing the same job at the same time under the same circumstances. If we did, we would know if this one is doing better or worse than that other one. And if we knew that, we would still only know he was better than one other president. So people who know how to compare are cautious about what they can interpret. Now, obviously, if you invade Poland, you can make that determination. But in the normal course of presidenting, it's pretty hard to know if it's a plus or a minus, except how you feel. And so people confuse how they feel with what's actually happening in the world. That's just one example of looser think. Another one would be the mind reading illusion. The idea that we know what strangers are thinking and their intentions are bad, and that we form entire opinions about that. Now, sometimes we're right, and we don't have the option of not imagining what other people are thinking, because it's just built into how we communicate. But we're so bad at it when it comes to famous people, politicians, people in the news, that if you don't realize that that's just guessing, and that we don't really know what people are thinking or why they do what they do, it's usually that's because there's some gap in your understanding of the world to imagine that you can read somebody's mind at a distance. So those are two examples. Another example would be the people who look at complicated situations and tell you that only one variable is the one that matters. So if you're looking at, something like healthcare, guns, any of these big questions, and you say, or the perfect example is Hillary Clinton. Why did she lose the election? People will give you one reason, but in fact, anybody who's a scientist or an engineer or economist would know that pretty much everything had to happen the way it did to get the result you got. There were probably hundreds of variables that if you tweaked any one of them, you could have had a Hillary Clinton victory. So anybody who says, it's because of this one thing, they're probably not trained in how to think about the world productively.
And I want you to tell us a bit about how those people that are caught in the bubble, as you described, who tend to be the artists, as you mentioned as well, how are these untrained brains ruining America, as the subtitle to your book suggests?
Well, it causes us to fight over things that we should be cooperating on, because you can imagine everything from infrastructure bills to healthcare to, you know, gun control, really everything comes down to, can you have a productive conversation in which you're looking at facts and using reason and a good approach? Take, for example, nuclear energy. Nuclear energy, even according to several of the Democrats, Cory Booker, Yang, et cetera, they say that nuclear is an essential part of dealing with climate change. Now, that's one of those topics that, nuclear energy, if we thought about it productively, we could actually solve climate change. And even the people who didn't believe that climate change was a problem still say, yeah, but we like nuclear, so let's just do lots of nuclear energy because we like clean air and clean water, and we like, to have electricity all day long, as opposed to the way we have it in California, which is we have it whenever the government decides we'll have electricity.
Very interesting. Well, Scott Adams, thank you so much for taking time with me this morning. It's been great to learn more about your fascinating career, the many endeavors you're currently working on as well. Continued success.
Thank you for having me on. I appreciate it very much.
Thanks for tuning in. And please join me for a special broadcast on Thursday, which will be my interview with former Tesla CIO and current founder and CEO of Tekion, Jay Vijayan.